The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Good morning. And thank you for all the announcements. I meant that, thank you, because it can seem a little bit like a lot, but it also gets a very, very, I think, clearer sense, perhaps, of that what IMC is a community, and that what we do here and can do here, are able to do here, is really comes out of a wide network or a wide community of support and people involvements, and so you got a taste of that, and I'm grateful for it. So as a prelude to the talk, I want to tell you a story. And if you've heard the story before, then imagine yourself in the story and to see not, what the solution of the story is, but rather how you would actually feel inside, the feelings you'd have when you hear the end of the story, the solution. The story has to do with a king, maybe a mischievous king, say it nicely, who gathered the three wisest, most intelligent people in his kingdom and said to them, "I'm going to lock you up in the high tower in a room, in a windowless room. I'm going to take and put you in that room, close the door, and you have 3 days to find your way out. And if you don't find your way out in 3 days, it's off with your head." So he marched these people up into the room and put them in the room and slammed the door closed. And they were kind of stunned. They stood there looking at what had happened. And they looked at the door. And lo and behold, the door had an extremely complicated lock on it. It was like a set of locks. There was a complicated puzzle lock, and there was a complicated combination lock, and there was some kind of bizarre key lock, and all of it kind of... So how do you sort through this? How do you get out? So two of them immediately went to work, studying the locks, looking at the locks, measuring the locks, putting things into the key lock, breaking them inside, feeling terrible. What do I do now? Trying to figure out this complicated puzzle, only to make it more and more complicated as they did. And calculating how many different options, possibilities there were for the combination. Trying to make sense of it, guessing. So two of them spent, 3 days kind of trying to figure out these locks. And one of them just kind of leaned up against the sat down, leaned against the wall of the room, and just sat there and napped and stretched and didn't do much at all. So the deadline was coming, and they hadn't figured it out. And they could hear the guards with their big, I don't know what they have, big axe with heads, beginning to clank up the stairs and coming for them. What do you do? And so then the one who had been just snoozing and laying against the wall finally got up and walked over to the door and pushed on it. And the door swung open. They had been so caught up in looking at the lock, thinking the lock was the problem, and that there actually the door wasn't even locked to begin with. It's just that they hung a big lock on it somehow. So, so what does that say about, that's a prelude to a talk about, in a sense, about papancha, a Pali word, Buddhist word, meaning the ways in which our mind proliferate into abstractions and how we get caught in those, fixated on them, in a way that sometimes makes the whole problem worse. We get entangled, and how sometimes we can use mindfulness as the sword that cuts through the Gordian knot, rather than trying to figure out how to untangle it. So that's a prelude to the talk. because I thought today I would begin by saying something about the events in Norway. I thought it was a big impact on the whole world, I think, and people here. And I didn't want to talk about it last week because it seemed so recent at the time. And it felt like often the good thing to do is to wait, to find out more. When you don't want directly impacted, sometimes it's better to wait and find out more, which we saw how important it was. And initially people thought it was some kind of jihad in Norway, and the people all alarmed. And then, you know, found out it was a Norwegian, then other kind of conclusions. And people kind of live on their conclusions before finding out everything is going on. So I thought last week, I don't want to talk about it because we don't know yet. But then I thought we can maybe rather than talking about it, we can talk about how powerful reactions we have, learning about it. And I thought, no, I think it's better to wait. And so I thought maybe today to bring it up. And thought of bringing it up in the context of this Buddhist concept, Buddhist idea of papancha, proliferation or objectification, or the way we get caught, obsessed in abstract thinking. So the thing in Norway, you know, it's particularly close to me because I'm Norwegian. I was born there, and I have lots of relatives there. And as soon as I found out about the shooting on the island, just outside of Oslo, I went and looked at a map to see, because I have an aunt and uncle who live just outside of Oslo in a place like that. I wanted to find out, you know, it's close to where they are. And they're on the opposite side of Oslo, so they weren't even close. And, you know, so it's a country I was born in, country that I've lived in, country I go back and visit, and know well, know the people well. And so it feels, you know, pretty close at home to have something like this happen. It was also quite beautiful to see, as a Norwegian, to know the culture there, to see the response of many of the people. And it was particularly touching for me to listen to the king, because I speak Norwegian. I could listen to his speech in Norwegian. And it's kind of unique. I don't know if this is other kings in other countries are like this, but I was thinking about the Norwegian king, and it's kind of like there's no power in the king, no authority. And I was thinking, it's kind of like the high shaman of the culture, or the high priest or priestess or something, you know. It has a particular role, which I don't think American culture has. I don't know if anybody in America has this kind of role, of being kind of representative of the whole people as a whole, and in particular representative of the best values of the people. And to kind of remind people of their best values and champion them and hold them up. And that's what came through in his beautiful speech that he had. And I felt reminding people and kind of his graciousness of heart and openness of heart. And it was quite beautiful. And the papers have been talking about, you know, how the Norwegians have been responding. And then as the week went along, we learned a little bit about the fellow who committed these crimes, this tragedy. And his lawyer claims that he's crazy. Insane is the word. And then reading something about his life and people who knew him in the last 20 years or so and describing him. And then reading his manifesto that he wrote, it seems that he was fixated, obsessed around thinking about his life and thinking about the world, thinking about Norway and Europe in a particular way. And from a Buddhist analysis, he was living in a very elaborate world of papancha, elaborate world of abstract thinking that has a logic of its own, and that he was kind of locked in. He was pulled in and obsessed or fixated on his own logic, his own inner abstractions and ideas, in such a powerful way that there was no, seemingly very little contact with reality. People who knew him say that that some of the claims he made about himself weren't really connected to reality, to what was actually the case. And so, you know. one of the teachings we've gotten here in the West from some Buddhist teachers is a teaching of not seeing people as other, but rather seeing, in a sense, seeing ourselves in them. And because if you see someone as other, we tend to shut down. If we see them ourselves in them, then there's some kind of openness and heartfulness that's possible. And so can we see ourselves in this man? And I could see in myself, that my initial reactions to this was also papancha. It was maybe a very small kind of representation of the kind of maybe much more dramatic way he is. To feel the strong sense of discomfort, strong sense of tragedy, alarm, or something like this, it's very easy for the mind to go into starting to obsess about, you know, why did this happen? Who's responsible? What has to happen? You know, and start operating from the point of view of opinions, operating the point of view of looking for solutions, and operating opinion of looking for blame. And often that kind of approach, the mind, it's easy to get locked in. And I remember after 9/11, we had a community meeting the next day in the evening. Maybe some of you were there. And one of the, you know, there wasn't much I could say, but we could hold the space for people to process it, to talk about how they're feeling and, you know, that. But it was really important that we set the stage for that discussion, that no one was supposed to say any opinions or what had to happen. Because as soon as you start getting to the politics of it, it closes the heart, it closes down. It's kind of, people don't find themselves. It's hard for a community of people to feel like they can relax and share how they actually are feeling individually, personally, if people are saying, this has to happen, or you know, this is what it's all about. There's a kind of, you know, once we get involved in that abstraction, interpretations, sometimes there's not room for people to feel seen and heard, or space for people, because they get put on, like, you know, you have to, you're with me or you're against me or you're something. So I could see in my own mind afterwards, you know, starting to take some of those routes with my mind, you know, wanting to conclude and wanting to get involved in abstract thinking and all that. And I think that, so in that way, in a small way, you know, we could see ourselves in that person. Luckily, many of us don't get obsessed and locked in to those views so tightly, strongly. the idea of papancha is a very important one for people who practice mindfulness to understand, to look at. And it has its own logic, the world of papancha. Once you get into the world of obsessing in the world of thoughts and thinking, imagery and ideas, it's very easy to lose touch with reality, lose touch with oneself, lose touch with a certain way of experiencing oneself in the world that's much broader and bigger, more inclusive than how it is when we see things only through the filter of thoughts or images or ideas. And it's so easy, I can see in my own mind, for that mind to kind of begin kind of settling into that nearer world. And I feel very lucky to have a mindfulness practice which regularly helps me to step out of that world. Or to open up beyond that world, so not my world's not limited to the world of thought. But you see, there's much more going on here than what you can, you know, than what's experienced or understood through ideas that we have. And I've seen, you know, that, you know, sometimes, you know, if you start getting into the world of thinking and ideas and the logic of it, it's kind of like the, you know, the Chinese finger trap. And the more you pull to try to get free, the tighter and tighter it gets. And you have to relax. You know, relax your head and, you know, go back, let the hands come together again. And then that that trap loosens up and you can get your fingers out. And so sometimes that, the thinking mind is like that, that the more we're in it, the more we get, trapped. The more complicated the Gordian knot becomes. The more we get entangled, and the more we get involved, get caught in the maze. And it can be very compelling. There has to be a solution. And there's a way in which obsessing about thoughts camouflages the cost of the obsession. It can't, we lose touch with kind of what actually how it feels, the tension, the tightness, the heat, the darkness that sets in. Because what's happening often is when we start obsessing about the world of thinking and ideas, we're doing what some people will call objectification. The mind is focusing on the object of awareness, object of something we can think about. And when we obsess about what, say if we're obsessing about what we're looking at, we might not be aware of what it's like to be looking. And so it happens like in movies, right? If you go to a movie, you're supposed, you know, ideally you're paying a lot of money to so something because you a lot of money so you can get, I don't know, a lot, but for some of us, a lot of money. So you can get properly obsessed, you can get objectify what's there, so you can really get into and involved in the movie. But I think most of you have had the experience of being in a movie theater and something happens to break the trance. And you look around and say, I'm in movie theater. I'm not in Hogsworth. And, you know, and all these people, you look around, you look at the people and, you know, they're all staring and all of them are kind of obsessed and focused and it's kind of like bizarre. You look around, you know. And you kind of broken the trance a little bit, and it's kind of interesting. And then you say, well, you know, wait a minute, I paid a lot of money. So you go back in. So the same thing can happen in the world of thinking. It's possible to kind of dive into that world and be involved in objectification of people, of things, of ideas, even about oneself. And because we're focusing on the object, we lose touch with something. We lose touch with ourselves, and there's even an alienation from ourselves. And that alienation from ourselves means we don't get all the information of what's happening. But what's happening, the discomfort we're happening, the feelings, the emotions are still there in the background, sometimes continuing to fuel the obsession. And there can be a feedback loop between how we're feeling, somewhat unconsciously, and are the force, the power that goes into continue to obsess and to think and all that. So I think many of you know this to some degree, because I think it's not uncommon for people to realize that they're spinning out or they're so caught up in something or stressed out that you need to do something to break, to relax. And so people will sometimes, you know, take a nap or they'll go exercise or they'll take a shower or they'll meditate or do something that helps the mind step out of itself, because if you stay obsessing and involved, it just feels a tension, a stress of that, just moves them on and on. And so I say, I need to break now. And sometimes you see that, I'm not going to find a solution to the problem I'm working on if I stay kind of all knotted up around it. I think I need to step out. And it's not uncommon for people to point out that how solutions to something, ideas, come when they're not when they're thinking about it intensely, but rather when they're in the shower or when they go for a walk or some other time. That there are other ways that other ways the mind operates than only coming to solutions through thinking ideas. In fact, obsessing about ideas and thinking sometimes makes it precludes the possibility of the creativity of the mind operating. The mind is much bigger than the thinking mind. The mind is much broader and wider. In fact, the way scientists are studying the mind these days, it's quite humbling to realize how much your thinking is a tip of the iceberg and how much is going on behind the scenes. So part of the function of mindfulness is to step, partly to step behind the scene. The image I like a lot is that of Toto pulling the curtain on the Wizard of Oz. You know, the Wizard of Oz in the movie was this omnipotent kind of figure and with a deep voice, I think. And then it turns out when the little dog pulls the curtains, he's just a little plump little guy standing there, a little microphone kind of thing. And suddenly he's not so omnipotent. So the same thing with mindfulness. Mindfulness pulls the curtain on the mind, so our thinking mind, the ideas, the obsessions we have, lose their omnipotence, and we can see, you know, more what's actually going on. And often the thinking mind in and of itself is you know, just, I don't know if it's a plump little guy or gal, but, you know, it's not, you know, it turns out not to be so omnipotent after all. So, the word is papancha, and sometimes it's translated into English as objectification, and sometimes as a proliferation of thinking. I think of it very closely connected to what's called discursive thinking. And discursive thinking is the kind of thinking where your thinking is having a conversation, where your thinking is holding forth with a discourse. It could be that you're having a conversation with someone else. It could be having a conversation with yourself. It could be you're repeating a conversation from the past, trying to come up with a better rejoinder. It could be you're planning a conversation in the future. It could be that it's a kind of abstract, not so much a conversation, but abstract thinking where you're analyzing, trying to figure out what's going on. And for people who spend a long, long time in this world of apancha, of abstractions, it can seem inconceivable, that's an interesting word here, inconceivable, unthinkable, that there's another way besides thinking. And that's part of this trap of the world of papancha, is it seems like that's all we know, it's all I know, and so I have to figure out the solution here. But there is, you know, that's maybe not where the solution is going to come. So mindfulness is that it can be the sword that cuts through the Gordian knot. Or say it a very different way, for me, I often get the sense that mindfulness is the road back to being at home. And that abstractions, this objectification, this discursive thinking, is a way of losing touch with the home that's in the heart, or the home that's in the mind. So to feel at home, like there's a real home, a place of comfort, a place of ease, a place of freedom, a place of warmth, a hearth, a place that feels has deep satisfaction, a place of meaning in one's own heart or in one's own mind, is one of the things that mindfulness or Buddhism is pointing to. Not as something to believe in, that there's a home in your heart, but something to experience, to know for yourself. And what that required is to step out of the obsession, step out of being lost and caught up in thought. So it can be as simple, at least to say it, as, in a sense, turning attention around 180 degrees and know that you're thinking. The way you would look and know that the sun is setting over the ocean, a beautiful sunset. You see it and you know it. You turn around and you know. You're not analyzing or thinking about the sunset and figuring out, you know, well, that red should be a little bit different place. And then you start obsessing. But you just kind of, you know it in a kind of clear, sensory way. So in the same thing, you can turn around and know the mind is now thinking. The mind is now involved in ideas. And in that, there's a stepping back. There's an opening up. You might not feel it right away, but with time, and start seeing, oh, that's the mind thinking. And there's a world of difference between being caught up in the world of thinking, looking for a solution, and being able to step back and say, oh, here's the mind that's thinking. Once you can step back, here's the mind that's involved in this conversation and discursive thinking and ideas, and here's the mind caught up in images, in its movies, then there starts to be a possibility of some openness or freedom or some space, space in the mind. Obsession, there's very little space in the mind. The obsessed mind is claustrophobic. The mindful mind has a lot of breathing room in it. And sometimes it's in our circles we talk about how mindfulness creates space around things, around our experience in the mind. In space, openness, being a little bit relaxed about how things are, those are not ideas. Those are not thoughts. There's not more obsession. It's an alternative to it, or it's another aspect of it. And as the mindfulness gets stronger, as the capacity for awareness gets bigger, as a relaxed awareness can become big and hold the experience rather than lost in the experience, the sense of space is there, or a sense of relaxation is there, or for me, the sense that there's something bigger going on here in my psychophysical being in this world than my thoughts and my ideas. And it can be again very foreign to people to think that everything is understood through thoughts and ideas. They were stepping back and become aware of something much broader. Some people mediate their world not so much through thoughts and feelings, and they're nodding in agreement with me perhaps, because for them, their obsession is their feelings, their emotions. And they were thinking I was going to get there. They're going to validate Gil's going to validate emotions. In a sense, maybe I am, but people can be just as obsessed about their emotions as they can about their thoughts and their ideas. And again, mindfulness opens up that world too, so that we're in a sense bigger than that. We're not caught by it. We realize that there's more space, or there's other processes going on here than this. And so, so there's something very, very very kind of difficult, perhaps, or challenging around this when we're encountering tragedy or when we're encountering crisis. And that is, when there's a crisis requires response. And sometimes a crisis requires an immediate response. Well, if it's really immediate, maybe you don't have any chance to do much at all. Because of the strong need, something needs to happen here. The old habit, or old very strong human tendency, to jump in looking for solutions and think about it and analyzing it, and especially if that's the route for solving things is thinking and ideas, we lock into that world, and we lock into the world of objectification of obsessive thinking or abstract thinking or analytic thinking that's where the solution is. But in order to be open to a wider capacity for processing, a wider capacity of tuning into the situation, it requires relaxing the fingers in the Chinese trap. It seems like we're asked to go in the opposite direction of what is needed in the situation. So in the time of crisis, unless you have to pull the kid from out of the road because the car is coming down the road, if you have time, one of the things that can be very, very helpful is to relax and make available other qualities, other capacities we have to inform the situation. So, for example, one of the very important qualities we have that doesn't come comes from a much broader capacity than just thinking, is our empathy. And our capacity for empathy is a very important ingredient, I think, to living a wise and careful life. So if you look at the Norwegian response, and then, many people in the world now are commenting, is that the Norwegian response publicly has been to go in the opposite direction of where you would think you'd go. Rather than closing up, rather than becoming more totalitarian as a society and having more rules and laws, they're saying this kind of thing is a challenge to the very deepest values we have of being an open, democratic society, inclusive society. So we're going to, our response to this is to go take a step further into that. We're going to open ourselves even more in some way. So as a country they do that, but I think we can do that for ourselves too. Rather than responding with crisis with tightening up, it's probably to our better interest to open up. And open up, partly what that means for me, the opening up, is to open up so more of our human capacity for processing, for feeling, for sensing, for understanding can operate at the same time. And what happens if, when we open up, when mindfulness shows us other capacities, we find that the mind can be a place we feel at home in. I don't think we can feel very much at home in the world of obsessive thinking because it's often tense, it's often uncomfortable. But I have found the way I like to describe it to myself sometimes is especially when I meditate, that sometimes my thinking quiets down, but sometimes I step away from the discussions, the abstract thinking I'm having, and in that stepping away, there's a sense of warmth, a sense of relaxation, a sense of peace, a sense of spaciousness, a sense of broadness, a sense of that's all associated with awareness itself. And so awareness feels like a place that's my home. And so you find when Buddhists sometimes talk about the heart as the home, the heart they're talking about is synonymous with awareness itself. Awareness becomes a home. Now, I don't know what your associations are with home is, but I mean, it's all complicated, people's lives. But if you kind of the stereotypic idea of home is a place where you can relax, home is a place you feel safe, home is a place where you can, you know, feel more peaceful and let go of the stresses of life. We have that capacity in our own minds to feel at home that way. And one of the things it requires to feel it is to be able to cut through the Gordian knot of abstract thinking, obsessive thinking, ideas. Not that ideas aren't important, not that abstract thinking isn't important, it is at times, but it's not the only game in town. And so if you have the capacity to know there's more, to understand the other games, or to understand, to step out of it, then it's possible to use abstract thinking more wisely and actually more effectively. We don't want to jettison that important part of human life, but we want to kind of have it in context, in this beautiful context where we feel at home in our mind. And in times of crisis, it can seem counterintuitive. It can feel like it's not okay. It's not even appropriate. To come back and to that home. Because how can, you know, sometimes people say, how can I feel this goodness inside of me, this sense of peace or well-being, when everything around me is burning, everybody else is suffering and struggling around me? You know, it doesn't seem right. I have to kind of like leave that place. Maybe, but maybe not. Maybe if we come from that place where we feel at home in our hearts, and kind of respond to crisis and to struggles in the world from that place, that we be able to respond and meet the world with much more what the world actually needs. Maybe it needs more compassion and love. Maybe it needs people to show that there's a way of being peaceful and at ease. So the last thing I'll say is, on my mind connected to this. I was asked this week to come help, I guess, talk for a benefit for Zen Hospice in San Francisco. And I was to be part of a conversation between a doctor and a practice of contemplative traditions. I'm the contemplative tradition guy. And to talk about the different approaches between towards death and dying for a doctor, kind of a standard doctor, I guess, and a contemplative approach. And, you know, death and dying are sometimes seen as a crisis. But what happens if we meet that with a mind that feels at home? What happens if we find our peace and ease with that? So I hope that all of you are very respectful and for yourself of whatever response, reaction that you have with tragedy in the world, like what happened in Norway. And I don't want, this talk is not meant to be disrespectful or to discount how you're feeling. But rather than that, is to show that there's a possibility of turning towards how you're feeling, and that it's very wise to do that. And that as you turn towards how you're feeling, you might discover a beautiful alternative of how to be in the world than being caught up in thoughts and abstractions and ideas and shoulds and shouldn'ts and blames and victims and that whole world, that objectification that we're capable of. So, thank you. We have a potluck today, and it's often nice when we're having a potluck. You know, some of you are new, and please feel free to stay. I believe we're a relatively friendly community, so please stay and meet our people and introduce yourselves. But it's also nice, perhaps, if you are at all inclined, to turn towards someone near you and just say hello. Especially those people who are new might appreciate having someone contact them and say hello, and then we can get ready for the potluck. So thank you.